The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my pleasure to welcome to the program today Jess Montgomery. She joins us on the telephone out there in Pennsylvania. Hello, Jess.
Hello.
Jess, this must be a very exciting day for you because your book, The Widows, has just been published officially today. How are you feeling about that?
Oh, I'm very excited. I'm thrilled. I'm grateful to Minotaur and my agent and my family, and I have to admit a few butterflies.
Would you describe this as a historical mystery?
Yes, I definitely would. It's set in the 1920s. It's inspired by Ohio's true first female sheriff, who was named Maud Collins. She becomes sort of the inspiration for my main character, Lily Ross. And Lily is investigating the murder of her husband, Daniel, who's a sheriff. In real life, Maud's husband was killed in the line of duty, and there was no mystery at all about what happened. But in The Widows, there's definitely a mystery, and Lily joins forces with another woman named Marvina, and together they investigate his murder, Daniel's murder, and Marvina's missing daughter, trying to figure out where she is. And in the process of that, they encounter a lot of, let's just say, dark underbellies to their community and have to make some decisions about, at the end, about what they're going to do to help their community.
How did you find out about the original true story that inspired this work of fiction?
Well, I stumbled upon it, believe it or not, on the internet. My younger daughter went to Ohio University at the time, and we sent our kids to college without cars. But our younger daughter is very outdoorsy, and we were visiting her for her birthday, and so I just started poking around about places to hike in southeast Ohio. And in doing so, I ran across the website for Vinton County, which is where Maud's actually from, and they were celebrating that, hey, we have the first female sheriff back in 1925. Interestingly enough, the reason they realized that was special was because another Ohio county thought they had the first sheriff in 1970, female sheriff in 1976. And Vinton County said, oh, 51 years earlier, actually, thank you. And they had a photo of Maud up on their webpage, and I was just struck by how both tender and tough this woman looked. She just looked so capable and yet so heartfelt in her photo. And I got to thinking, well, what if there were a character like her who didn't know that her husband, who had killed her husband, and why? What would she do? And I just took it from there, and from there the story just sort of blossomed.
And the story is told from these alternating viewpoints of Lily and Marvina. And
yes.
They are both widows, and Lily, as the story opens, her husband is quickly murdered, and she doesn't really believe what's happened, and they decide, surprisingly, to make her the acting sheriff, but this is kind of a figurehead thing. They don't really expect her to do anything, do they?
Correct. In the story, that is true.
Okay, so we have these two alternating viewpoints, and we have this guy who we know very little about because, well, number one, he's dead, and number two, these two women, they know him very well, they think, but each woman knows totally different things about him. And throughout the story, we find out more and more about him, don't we?
We do. And when I was first writing the novel, I started out by writing it entirely from Lily's point of view. She is the character who has the strongest and hardest character arc and growth to go through. but I started, you know, I knew I needed to really understand who is Daniel. I didn't want him to just be, well, it's so sad that he was murdered and move on. I wanted him to somehow come alive on the page. So I actually wrote about 90 pages from his point of view, as if his life were flashing before his eyes. And then I threw out those 90 pages because I realized I felt like that was just kind of too convenient of a device. And I don't know, it just felt a little cheesy to me, at least the way I handled it. But in writing those 90 pages, I also got to know him really well. And emerging in those pages was this childhood friend named Marvina. And so she became a sort of minor character, and then she kind of grew to a secondary character. And then as I kept writing, I realized, oh, no, she's a point-of-view character, because exactly what you said. She understands Daniel from his youth, and so she understands him from one point of view. And Lily, his wife, who met him, you know, when they were older, and definitely when he was older, he's about 6 years older than her, understands him as an adult male, and so the two together can come to a full understanding of who this man was, that they both loved in different ways. It's not a love triangle at all, as you know, but they both, you know, Marvina loves him as friend and Lily loves him as his wife, and together they can form a whole picture of him. And I think in that way, he's a presence on every page. I think he comes to life without being there.
And your efforts in this, what appeared to be a false start, writing all this about Daniel, actually proved to be quite valuable, because you were figuring out who he was and figuring out this other character, Marvina, weren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I do not consider those pages to be not worthwhile at all. Because exactly that, I figured him out, and that helped me figure out more of the story. And actually, what's kind of fun is when Minotaur first sent out advance copies to some folks, they asked me, well, do you have any material that, you know, we could use as, like, bonus material? And I said, well, I have these drafts of letters that Daniel wrote from World War I to Lily and to Marvina that I played with. Mm-hmm. And they said, oh, could you clean those up and send them over? So I did, and actually if people sign up for my email newsletter on my website, they automatically get two letters from Daniel, one to Lily and one to Marvina.
Oh. My guest is Jess Montgomery. Her new novel is The Widows, and I'd like to point out that this is the debut of Jess Montgomery, but the woman we have on the telephone with us right now has written a number of other books under another name. What's your other name? I think you're probably familiar to a lot of people here in our listening area.
I think so. I hope so. Yeah, my other name is Sharon Short.
Voila.
Ta-da!
What made you decide to pick up a pen name?
Well, for folks who have read my novels as Sharon Short, they'll know that I have written mysteries before. The most recent series as Sharon Short was a comedic mystery series about a laundromat owner. So very different than what I'm writing as Jess Montgomery. And it was also a contemporary series and set in the present in first person, both. So very different sensibility there. And then I wrote a novel called My One Square Inch of Alaska, which is a coming-of-age literary novel. There are mysterious elements to it, but it's not a mystery. And again, it's written in the first person, past tense, set in the 50s. So not contemporary, but not as historic a time as the 1920s. So it just felt like, as The Widows evolved, that this was a very different... I mean, my point of view about the world and people and relationships, you know, you can see a continuity among all my works. But my style of writing and the voice is very different in The Widows. And so it just made sense to, you know, my agent found that to be true. And so she suggested, why not a pen name? Lots of authors do it. Mm. And so I said, that could be fun. All right, we'll give that a try.
Well, we had you on the program for your previous book as Sharon Short, and we probably have a couple listeners out there who are saying, Sharon Short, now how do I know Sharon Short? Tell us who Sharon Short is. Who are you?
Yeah, I've been the director of the Antioch Writers Workshop, which had a long-time home in Yellow Springs, as you know, and then moved a couple years ago to University of Dayton, so some folks may know me in that regard. And I write a column called Literary Life in the Dayton Daily. That's been running for, 5 years or more, and it's about other writers. I don't review books. I leave that to my colleague, Vic, but I interview writers and, you know, write about events in the literary arena. And before that, I had a column called Sanity Check that was about sort of humorous takes on home life and raising children and juggling life and career and whatnot. So a lot of different ways for people to know me in the Dayton area.
I remember Sanity Check. That was rather Bombeckian.
It was a bit Bombeckian, if I may say, not at her level, of course, but yes, it was a bit in that vein.
My guest is Sharon Short, Jess Montgomery, and you have an opportunity to meet her. She's debuting the book, Rolling It Out. It just came out, and she will be at Books and Company this afternoon at 2 o'clock, Saturday, yeah. January 12th. She'll be at Books and Company at the Green out in Beaver Creek, 2 o'clock this afternoon. She'll be giving a talk and signing copies of the book. What do you have planned for them this afternoon? You going to read from the book? What do you got going?
I'm going to read from the book. I have a couple passages in mind that I'm not going to do the traditional reading from the first page forward. I have a scene a little later in the book that isn't a spoiler, but kind of shows, I want to showcase the relationship between Lily and Marvina, because they start out a bit wary of each other. Marvina knows who Lily is, but Lily's never heard of Marvina until after Daniel's death. So understandably, they're a little tense when they first meet in person.
Mm-hmm.
But as the novel goes on, they become friends, and they learn to trust each other, and they kind of grow from their relationship with one another and find some peace through that relationship. So I have a scene in mind that I want to read that shows the start of that. And then I'm going to share a bit of the background that I've shared with your listeners about how did I come across the idea and what was the publication journey. And from there, I love question and answer. So I hope people come with lots of questions about the book or about the writing life, and I'll do my best to answer those questions.
That's 2 o'clock this afternoon, Saturday, January 12th. You can meet Jess Montgomery at Books and Company in the Green in Beaver Creek. And you mentioned a few moments ago these letters. If readers go to your website, they can see these letters that were written to Marvina and Lily by Daniel. And these were written during World War I. What is your website address?
It's www.jessmontgomeryauthor.com. And, yeah, if people sign up for my email newsletter, they get this bonus material of these two letters that Daniel wrote from the front.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and I'll continue my conversation with Jess Montgomery right after this. The Book Nook continues on WYSO. I've been joined by Jess Montgomery on the telephone, and we're talking about her new novel. This is set in that same year that you found the original female sheriff, 1925, which was just 7 years after the armistice in World War I, and Daniel served in World War I, which was this horrific industrialized slaughter. And then 7 years later, we have this setting in Appalachian coal country, Ohio, and things are not good. This is very horrifying to read. What is it about this period and about this horrifying history of oppression of these poor coal miners? This is just startling to read. Was it really that terrible?
Yes, it absolutely was. I did a lot of research, a lot of reading. The Battle for Blair Mountain that I reference in the book is a completely true event. There's a scene where Marvina is trying to inspire men to unionize, which was a really risky thing to do. And she cites all these events in that area. And it's all that page and a half where she's speechifying, if you will, about these events. Every single one of those events is absolutely true. So my family of origin is Appalachian. They're from eastern Kentucky. My family members were mostly tobacco farmers and then became factory workers. And there was a saying in my family as I grew up that, well, at least we're not coal miners, which sounds really disparaging and horrible, except it wasn't meant that way. It was meant as acknowledgement that that work is so brutally hard and so dangerous. And certainly as time has gone on, there have been increased safety practices, but we still hear about, you know, just really difficult conditions and tragic events that happen to these men who, you know, are working really difficult physical labor and mental labor too. I can't imagine the strength it would take emotionally and mentally to do that work. My father was a tool and die man, and he was a very ardent union supporter. So, therefore, I grew up as a very ardent union supporter. So I was familiar with that aspect, that the importance in our family of my father being in a strong union. But I did spend a lot of time in southeastern Ohio, around and in the towns that a few are still coal mining towns. It certainly died off considerably compared to the era in which I have set the novel. But in one small town, I got to spend some time with a couple of retired coal miners. They were a little wary of me at first. Like, you know, why are you interested in us was kind of the approach. But then when they realized I was sincerely interested, I got to sit down and chat with them. And I think one of the things that made them trust me was one said, well, you know, it's cold out. If we go inside this coal mining museum, we're going to have to use coal to heat the museum. Would you be okay with that, a coal-fired stove? And I said, are you kidding? Of course I would. Yeah, that'd be wonderful. This is research. So they told me a lot of tales about their own experiences, their father's experiences. They pulled up an old WPA film made in the 1930s about their area, and I just gleaned a lot of sort of firsthand information about how challenging it was. And they were both really glad to not be mining anymore because it was so physically difficult and dangerous, but yet you could see the bond they had with the kinship they had with one another of having gone through that experience. I acknowledge them both in the novel.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSL, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, it's the Book Nook. My guest is Jess Montgomery. Her new novel is The Widows. And Jess, while you're doing your research, did you have to drink a little moonshine just to see what it tasted like?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah,
now moonshine, you know, you can buy it in the Kroger's. You know, you can go into the store and buy some version of moonshine, legally manufactured, obviously. I'm sure it's not what it tasted like back in the day. I did chat with my dad about, I actually asked him for help in understanding shotguns, and because I don't know a lot about hand weapons. So, and he was a hunter from the time he was four. So he knew a lot about guns. He passed away this past fall. So he didn't get to see the book come out, but he was very proud to help me understand all that. And then he got this sort of twinkle in his eye, and he said, well, you know, you aren't going to have to write about moonshine if you're writing about that area and that time frame. And I said, yes. So then he fessed up, you know, with a few stories of his own back when he was a teenager, which was quite a while ago. He was born in 1924, about moonshine and what it tasted like and how it still worked. And so that was very helpful information.
My late father-in-law was from rural Kentucky, and I don't remember him ever mentioning moonshine, but he was very sentimental about outhouses.
I can't say my dad ever expressed a real sentimental feeling about outhouses.
I kept waiting in the book for you to mention the outhouse, but you don't. But a really key thing happens in the story when someone is going to the bathroom, but you're going to have to read the book to figure that out. My guest is Jess Montgomery. The book is The Widows. You have a lot of villains in your story, and many of them are anonymous. They are Pinkertons. Tell us about what you refer to in the book as the Pinks. Who were these guys?
So they were hired security men. And, you know, it was there wasn't as robust a law enforcement community as there is now in towns and counties. So they would be hired in often by coal mining owners, you know, to help with security. And they weren't all bad. There's no group of people that are all evil or all bad. But I lean towards the villainous side in the novel. Because hey, it's my novel, so I can do that. But the parts where they talk about coal mining camps being shot up with Tommy guns, that really did happen. I mean, there was no particular regulation of how these folks operated, and so Pinks in the 20s was a pejorative term for men who were Pinkertons. Not the way the term was used in the 50s, but it's how it was used in the 20s. And I do have one moment where Lily is realizing how, you know, a lot of the guys who became Pinkerton agents, you know, were kind of desperate too. So they were just trying to make a living too. So there's always two sides to every story. But yeah, they play a... They're a scary presence, to say the least.
And as harrowing as your depiction is of what the life was like for these coal miners and their families, this is 5 years before the Great Depression hit. I can just imagine how much worse it must have gotten after 1929.
Yeah, that's very true. And I'm writing the sequel to this book, and I hope there'll be more after the sequel, but it's set in 1926. And, of course, things are still roaring. It's the roaring 20s, not in the sense of what we think of in the cities, but in the sense that the economy is pretty good. And so I have a few characters making choices based on, hey, this is great. This is never going to end, right? And I feel a little heartbroken for them because I have plans for what happens to them when, well, you know, things go awry with the Great Depression.
You have a character in this story, The Widows, who is an 11-year-old boy, and he's forced to go work in a very dangerous place in the coal mine because one of his relatives is unable to work. Did they really do this kind of stuff?
Yeah, I got that from meeting with those two coal mining men that I mentioned earlier in the interview in this museum, in this little coal mining museum. There was this teeny little helmet, and I said, "What's that?" And I said, "Oh, that was used, you know, that's what the boys wore." Excuse me. And, you know, they pointed out, and I've read a lot of data that and research that, well, legally, they weren't really, you know, they weren't really supposed to put in kids that young, but sometimes they would just because, you know, hey, that they weren't being monitored. Who's around to monitor them or punish them? It's payment for, you know, often large families, and smaller boys could fit in these narrower passages to do the work they needed to do. So, yeah, that's true.
Jess, as we get further into your novel, The Widows, we find that these separate alternating viewpoints by Lily and Marvana merge into chapters so that suddenly we have Lily and Marvana really alternating within each chapter. And the section where this 11-year-old boy gets into a situation, this is the most dramatic thing, the suspense you build and the drama. This is really like a blockbuster kind of thing right here in this section. What was that like to write for you without giving away what's going on?
Right. That was really hard to write. I actually wrote the scene that you're referring to while I was at Thurber House in Columbus. I was blessed to have a residency there for a month a couple years ago for the purpose of working on this novel. And that writing the draft of that scene, because, you know, I'm alone in the third story apartment of Thurber House by myself, writing this scene, and I actually stopped and said out loud, can I really do this? I wasn't sure I wanted to put myself through this. And then I thought, no, you have to write this scene. One of the gentlemen I interviewed talked about that actually happening, the coal mining company blasting in one side of a mountain and some negative things happening as a result. So I asked his permission to, you know, do you mind if I incorporate this? And he said, sure, that's fine. But yeah, it was a really tough scene to write, but I'm glad to hear you say how harrowing it was for you to read. It was harrowing for me to write, I have to admit.
Was that apartment in the Thurber House the one where the authors in legend have supposedly written all kinds of things, I think, on the wall in the closet?
The closet's a floor down where
okay.
you sign it. But no, this is the third story apartment that they set aside for, I think it's like two or three residencies a year.
You know what I'm talking about, the autographed wall?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Lots of interesting stuff on there I've heard. I've never seen it.
Ah, you should take a visit. It's a very wonderful museum and organization.
My guest is Jess Montgomery. We're talking about her debut novel as Jess Montgomery. She's written a number of novels as Sharon Short, and you can meet her. She'll be at Books and Company this afternoon for an event celebrating the publication of her book, The Widows. It just came out. That's at 2 o'clock this afternoon, Books and Company in Beaver Creek. That's Saturday, today, January 12th. Okay, we start off with this murder of the sheriff, Daniel. And he becomes the ghost who hovers over the entire novel. But as we get further in, we find another murder mystery unfolding. And maybe they're connected. We don't know. But this is a particularly tragic mystery of who killed this other person. And without getting into any details or spoilers,
mm-hmm.
What made you decide to kill off another one of your characters? Another character who we don't really know except post-mortem.
Right. Well, let's see. How can I answer that without giving away any spoilers? So this person's loss becomes a driving force thematically and also to makes the plot hang together.
Mm.
It pulls together people in the community and provides clues. I can put it that way, yes. It helps provide clues as to what really happened to Daniel and why.
And can I talk about the principal villain? Am I allowed to say he's a villain? I mean, he kind of acts villainous from page one, doesn't he? Am I allowed to talk about him? Okay. All right.
Well, we can talk about him in general, but let's not name names. Just
okay. Well, there's another villain in here that, according to your credits in the back, you got the inspiration for this character from a guy named Ron Rollins over at the Dayton Daily News. Now, how did that happen?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So Ron was an early reader for the draft of The Widows. So thank you, Ron, if you're listening. And we met for lunch so he could, you know, give me his feedback. And he said, you know, you're missing a character that needs to kind of, you need to put a face on the general threat that's lurking in the town.
Mm.
And so I realized he was right, And we started brainstorming names. And actually, I'll share the name. It's Abe Miller. We just sort of pulled it off of a Miller beer ad on the wall. And I forget why we came up with Abe. But, yeah, credit goes to Ron for that one.
Well, speaking of names, where'd you get the name Jess Montgomery?
Well, Montgomery is an homage to the fact I live in Montgomery County and was born in and grew up in Montgomery County. And also the Montgomery County Arts Council has been very generous with me and other artists with support grants. And so I felt it was important to give my home county a nod, especially like the notion of giving my home county a nod since I'm, you know, writing about a sheriff who's the sheriff of the county I've created. So that's where I got Montgomery. And then Jess, honestly, I just went on to the social security website that has most popular names,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, decided to pick a name that would make me, that would read a little younger than Sharon. So it was very calculated. I picked three, I think, and I texted them to my daughters and my agent and a couple friends, and I had them vote. And they picked Jess. And Jess, I also felt, as a single syllable, worked really well with Montgomery.
All right. Well, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you about your new novel.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed it, too.
My guest has been Jess Montgomery. Her new one is The Widows. And you can meet her this afternoon. She'll be at Books & Company for a signing in Beaver Creek at The Green. That's 2 o'clock this afternoon. Jess will be talking about The Widows and autographing it. And you say you're working on book number 2. Do you have an idea what that's going to be about, or is this one that you're going to end up changing and revising 80 million times and it'll totally change?
It'll probably change a lot. But it's set a year and a half later. Lily is still dealing with the emotional fallout of losing her husband. She's running for sheriff in her own right, and an elderly woman who nobody knows who she is found murdered in a remote part of Lily's County, and so she starts investigating, and it's called The Hollows, so hopefully it will be out in 2020.
Good title.
Thank you.
My guest has been Jess Montgomery. Her new one is The Widows. Thanks, Jess.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Don't go away. I have a very special surprise final segment for you this morning. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. Back in 1994, when I interviewed my first author on this program, it wasn't really a program. I was hosting a music show, Afternoon Excursions. And I interviewed an author named Anne McCaffrey, the late Anne McCaffrey. And then that same day, I got a call back from her co-author on that book. And she wanted to be interviewed, too. So I did two author interviews the very first day I interviewed authors on Why So. Well, 25 years later, here we are talking about books still on the program. And I've been looking back at a lot of interviews I did many years ago. And up next, we're going to bring you an interview I recorded 21 years ago with a woman who is considered the queen of British crime fiction, the late P.D. James. I only had her on the program one time. Let's listen. My guest is P.D. James. Her new book is A Certain Justice. Without giving away too much, what's the basic plot of this one?
Well, it is, as I said, set in the world of the criminal law, and the victim is a woman barrister, a senior barrister, called Venetia Aldridge, who is beautiful, talented, immensely successful, but has made quite a number of enemies in her life, has a failed marriage, and a very unhappy and rather neglected daughter. And the book opens with her defending a young psychopath accused of brutally slashing to death his aunt. And Venetia is a brilliant lawyer, and by a very clever piece of cross-examination of the prosecution's chief witness, she does secure an acquittal. And the consequences of that acquittal are absolutely horrendous.
You have woven quite a tale of intrigue here. You build the characters
into real believable people. The aunt who was murdered had a bit of a dark side herself.
Oh, she did. She did. Yes. Well, I think this is tremendously important to me. I mean, I am writing a mystery, so I do want a strong plot, and I want a credible puzzle with honest clues. But basically, I'm trying to write a very good novel, and that means, of course, that the people must be real. The reader must feel these are real, suffering, living human beings with their problems and their motives and their compulsions and their private sorrows and difficulties. Because I think, myself, I can't be interested in any novel unless, of course, I'm tremendously interested in the people and wanting all the time to know more about them and what happens to them next.
My guest is P.D. James. I think many people in this country, when they think of this genre, they think of pulp fiction. They think of works of literature that are kind of throwaway works of literature.
Yes.
Your
yes.
books are really a cut above. You are such a fine writer. I am just amazed by your style. How did you come to this style?
Well, I knew from very early childhood that I wanted to write. And I suppose a lot of my life was some kind of preparation for it. I read widely and I wrote a great deal, not for publication, but just writing and trying to hone the style. And I have been writing now for a large number of years, and I hope that I have improved. One always hopes to improve. But a really good style and the proper use of English, those are tremendously important to me as a writer. And I do agree that I'm afraid in the genre there are books written which really are not, I think, perhaps fit for more than just to be read and give us entertainment for an hour or two and then be discarded. But I'm hoping not to be that kind of novelist.
My guest is P.D. James. Your stories have enjoyed tremendous success as television broadcasts. How do you feel about the way that they portray your characters on television? Do you think they do a good job of making them come to life? Would you make them appear that way if you had some control over it?
Well, it's a difficult question. I think on the whole, they have done a good job, and I have a great deal to be thankful for. And with some of the stories, they've done exceptionally well. I have mixed feelings about others. I think it's very rare that you find a character on the screen who exactly represents your own private picture of a character. That would be almost too much to hope for, really. And there are always things, I think, which irritate writers. We get very irritated if there are plot changes which we think are unnecessary, and we get irritated, most of all, I think, if somebody else's dialogue, the adapter's dialogue, is substituted for our own. My feeling is that if there is a scene in the story and I've already written the dialogue, then I want my dialogue to be used and not someone else's. But, you know, I think all writers have mixed feelings about television, and I've certainly been far luckier than most, I think.
So you occasionally have cause to wince when you watch them.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think nearly every writer has causes to wince a little at some time or other.
One thing I think that amazes readers about you is your ability to depict gore.
Yes.
How do you come by this talent?
Well, I don't honestly know, but I can answer that thing. I think it's very difficult for a writer to know how she comes by a talent. A talent is given, and I think it comes probably at birth. I knew from very early childhood I wanted to be a writer, so I don't know how exactly it is that I can produce gore or create a character or think up a plot. But as far as the gore is concerned, there aren't many actual descriptions of murder in my books, but there are some very vivid descriptions of the finding of dead bodies. And that's a very important moment for me in the book, because I always describe the finding of the body through the eyes of the person, the character who makes the discovery. And that's a moment, of course, of great horror and emotion and terror and surprise, all sorts of mixed emotions, horror predominating for that character. And I think the reader ought to share those emotions. The reader should also feel shock and horror at this appalling event.
Well, there's definitely a cathartic moment when a corpse is discovered in your new book, A Certain Justice.
Yes, with poor Venetia, indeed. because she is discovered, as you know, in her office, sitting in her swivel chair, and dead, and with a wig on her head covered with blood.
And up until this time, we really have not encountered your protagonist, and we've grown attached to Venetia.
Well, I'm glad you say that. A lot of people feel she is so awful as a woman and they dislike her very much, but I don't really dislike her. I mean, she has enemies and she has grave faults, but I try to show why she is the kind of woman she is, the childhood that made her not only the kind of woman she is, the kind of lawyer she is. And she has virtues, really, of courage and intelligence and, I think, professional integrity.
And she had a very difficult childhood.
Oh, a very, very difficult childhood, and a very lonely one.
And I was struck by the truism of the gentleman who influenced her to go into the law, the fact that this fellow was sort of a wimpy professor type.
Yes, exactly.
And for anyone that's ever gone to a boarding school, we know this type of person. We know the guy who becomes the butt of the students' jokes. And
they're pathetic, very sad characters. And, of course, Mr. Froggitt, or the Frog, as the boys call him, is using this clever girl, training her for the career that he always longed to have and was never able to have, because not only did he not have the educational advantages, but, of course, he hadn't got the voice, he hadn't got the presence. He could never have been a great criminal lawyer himself. And it's his immense satisfaction to think that this clever young girl who's so interested in the law, that he is training her to be a lawyer, introducing her to these older cases. At night they sit in his room and take the part of the prosecutor and the defense. He's almost training her. And as you know, I mustn't give the plot away, he does in fact come back into the book with a clue to her murder, which is absolutely fundamental to solving the case.
Mm-hmm. Well, we won't get into that.
We won't get into that.
You spent a long period of time in the British Civil Service, including the police and criminal law departments. Did you get some good ideas for future books during your career?
Well, I didn't get ideas for plots for future books, but I got absolutely invaluable experience, you know, for background, for settings. For example, I was responsible for administering the Forensic Science Service, and I wrote a book called Death of an Expert Witness, which is set in a forensic science laboratory. I don't think I could have written that book without, you know, the specific knowledge about how the service was organized and how the forensic scientists thought about their job. And it's true, I think, with other books that I experienced in the British Home Office and in the world of criminal law, and the fact that when I was in the police department, I met senior police officers. All of this was immensely valuable to a crime writer.
My guest is P.D. James. If we were to be able to look at the book that you're reading right now, I'm willing to wager it's not one of the books in this genre. What are you reading right now?
It's funny you should ask that. It's been what I have been trying to read, Vic. I have never been able to read Anthony Powell's The Dance to the Music of Time, which is regarded as one of the great novel series of the 20th century. So I thought I'd bring the first three volumes, which are bound in one in a paperback, and make another attempt on this journey. And I hate to tell you I still can't read it. I'm pressing on, but it's one of those books where there's a succession of characters introduced, and I'm just waiting for something to happen. I'm waiting for them to do something. Anyway, perhaps I should press on with it. It's probably a fault in me, really. But it's interesting how books which we know are very highly regarded sometimes don't actually appeal to us personally. And one never knows whether to keep on persevering or to just say, well, I shall never change where this book is concerned.
When you write a book, how long does it take you to come up with the idea? Or do you just start writing and kind of figure out where you're going as you move along?
Oh, no, no. I suppose even with crime writing, there are writers who do that and produce very, very good books. But with a classical detective story, which is so carefully clued, in which the plot has to be so logical, I don't think I could ever do that. So the book is plotted and planned in very, very great detail before I begin writing. I have charts. I have do an immense amount of research. I have lots of books full of notes. But what is interesting is that nevertheless, during the writing, the book does change, often in rather mysterious ways. So I never really get the book that I thought I was going to get.
Dare I be so bold as to inquire as to your next effort?
Well, when people say, are you writing now? I'm sometimes tempted to say, no, I'm signing books for a long line of people. You can't do both. When I'm actually promoting a novel, I certainly haven't any energy left over to write another one. I just hope that when I eventually get home, perhaps in April or May, I shall begin, well, I shall certainly open my mind to the possibility of receiving the next idea. I hope it won't be too long coming, but who knows? It may be a long time before it comes, because I don't begin until I have an idea which really excites me. That's why the books don't come out once a year.
I just have one more question. What are some of the books that you have read in the last few years that you particularly enjoyed?
Well, that would need a great deal of thought, really. I don't think that's the sort of question you can just answer
okay.
off the top of your head, because in the last few years I must have read so many hundreds, really. So really, just the ones that come in mind recently, I've certainly enjoyed Kerr Tomlin's biography of Jane Austen. I've enjoyed the letters of Nancy Mitford. I've enjoyed Selina Hastings' biography of Nancy Mitford. Let me see now. I've read a lot of history, but I can't offhand say which ones I've really most enjoyed. I have reread a great deal of Trollope, and I love Trollope.
Which one?
Particularly the Barchester novels.
Okay.
And I'm very fond of The Small House at Allingham, although I know that the heroine there is particularly irritating heroine. But I still do enjoy the small House at Allingham. So Trollope, very much. I've been reading Henry James, beginning to enjoy Henry James. So I set pleasure from The Golden Bough.
Well, thank you.
Those are just some that come, but I mean, in the last few years, so many hundreds of books read or reread, it would be quite difficult to, I suppose in my own genre, I'd have to say The Moonstone, which I did reread. I've read that many times. And Dorothy L. Sayers' The Nine Tailors, set in the Fen Country, which I think is a wonderful detective story because of the atmosphere.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your list. I know that many of our listeners are curious to know what you read for pleasure, and it gives them some good advice as well.
Well, it's such an individual thing, isn't it, really, that you can never quite know whether the books you like, you can safely recommend other people may enjoy them or may not. It's a very subjective pleasure. But those are all books I've greatly enjoyed. And I certainly reread the old detective stories, mostly by women. I can still read Marjorie Allingham and Niall Marsh and Dorothy L. Sayers with great pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
A great pleasure to talk to you, and thank you very much for having me on Book Nook.
That was P.D. James, the late P.D. James, recorded 21 years ago. My only interview with her, she was the grande dame of British crime novels, and she made an appearance in Dayton, Ohio, 21 years ago, and she was excited about coming through. You didn't hear this in the interview. I cut it out. But she was excited because she had been a longtime friend of the late Roz Young, who wrote for the Dayton Daily News for many years. And during the conversation that we had that day, she said that her cat and Roz Young's cat had been carrying on a long conversation, a long correspondence by mail, which I found to be rather fascinating. P.D. James, who died 5 years ago, her voice coming to you on this segment of the Book Nook. And over the years that I've been doing the program, 22 years ago, I interviewed James Lee Burke for the first time. He has made more appearances on the program than any other author by far. He has a new book that just came out this week. We tracked him down recently in Montana, and you can hear my interview with James Lee Burke tomorrow morning at 10:30 right here on The Book Nook. Thanks for listening.